Welcome to the quiet little corner of YouTube called Brother Owl's Garden. I'm Brian, and I honor your presence here today, as well as honoring the presence of my dear friend and brother, Kiara Windrider, coming to us again, gracing us with his presence and all of his spiritual wisdom like a fountain, all the way from India. Kiara, welcome, brother.
Good to see you again, Brian, and be back on your channel.
Thank you. I'm always very grateful, as I know our viewers are, to have you. Kiara, I wanted to throw a question at you. I personally am seeking a higher, clearer understanding with a matter that I think many others will relate to. Back in, I think it was March, back in March, I posted a video called Worship. And in that video, I explained the best understanding that I had at that time of what worship is all about, what it's for, why we do it. And it still makes complete sense to me, the things that I shared on that video. But there's more. The question that I have not come to a realization about within my own self is, if we are the I am, if we are a sunbeam of the great sun, if we are an emanation of the supreme entity, if we are a spark of God, however you wish to word it in your own preference, if we are that, why are we worshiping? And I would like to clarify that I'm not saying prayer. I'm not saying communion. I'm saying worship, bhakti. And so I need, and I think other viewers will agree, they could use some further clarification on, if we are that, why do we worship that, as all the established religions do? What say you, brother?
That's probably one of the biggest questions around. And so much of it has to do with perspective, isn't it? So it's like when you say, if we are that, I am, we've already created a subtle separation. So, you know, if so, I'm saying that we are the I am. Which we are we talking about? And why do you say the I am as if it was something separate from everything else? So, whenever you objectify something as the I am, then you're separating yourself from the identification with that essence. And I think this is just the nature of language.
Yeah.
And somehow language has shaped our beliefs. It has shaped our experience. And maybe let's dive into this a little bit. So when I say that I am, it's an attempt to bring those two into union. So the personal, so, you know, even language here again. So when I'm speaking about the separation between what I consider the personal self and what I consider the universal self. So I, personal, I, universal, that I am, all of it. So when I really experience it through the lens of the universal self, there's no personal self. When I can speak that from the lens of the personal self, I create a separation between my personal self and that universal self. So it's language, and it's also somehow the nature of our evolution at this time. And this is really important to understand. There's you know, there's a process, there's an evolutionary unfolding that has a place. You know, at this time in our soul evolution as a species, it's important to experience the separation, right? I mean, we do, no doubt. And even on a spiritual path, most people think in terms of worship as a means for connecting with that universal self. We can call it God. We can call it presence. We can call it Brahman. Each of them has a slight variation in terms of how we understand that and how we embrace that. But when I say that or this, what do I really mean? You know, it's my perception of this or that. But the perception I'm bringing with me as a personal self is always going to have this idea, this concept of separation within it. Always. It's always going to separate things in terms of qualities, in terms of hierarchies, in terms of preferences. So, and even when we get to some of the highest spiritual philosophies from India, there's still that aspect of separation. So Advaita, Vedanta Advaita. You know, it's a beautiful philosophy. It's like the idea that everything is part of this, the one universal consciousness. But then, in order to understand who I am as a personal self, we see that through the veil of Maya and create a separation. So this is illusion. This world is illusion, and that is the ultimate truth. So for me, what I've come to understand, and this is really the essence of Kashmir Shaivism, we talked about this last time, is that Shiva and Shakti are really so closely entwined together. Shiva is pure consciousness. Shakti is the emanation of that consciousness in the worlds of creation. So whenever you create a separation, like using the term Maya as illusion, then there's, you know, that which is the ultimate truth, and this which is the illusion of truth, or even a reflection of that ultimate truth. And, you know, this is very, very subtle, Brian. But I'm really understanding now how we have kept ourselves asleep through this concept of Maya, the concept of ultimate truth. Because what is to say that I, as a personal self, am not also ultimate truth? I mean, this is a big question. So what if I, so we talked about devotion, you talked about bhakti. So we have an image, okay, maybe Krishna, maybe Jesus, maybe Buddha, maybe Allah, maybe whatever. Or maybe a master, an ascended master, or a deity, or a nature spirit, or a guide. You know, this, we, or even the higher self, which is a mediator. The higher self is not universal self. It's not personal self. It's the soul aspect of the one spark, which then creates the experience of the personal self. And it's
like an adapter.
It's, yeah, maybe. I mean, that's a good way. So it's like in between.
Interface.
It's an interface. It's
interface, that's the word, yeah.
Right. So even that, you know, when I say, when I identify with the higher self, when I identify with the personal self, when I identify with the universal self, that identification, if I'm trying to state that in words, will lead to bhakti. You know, it creates a concept of something out there that's separate from what's in here, and therefore I devote myself to that. I might call it Shakti, Mother Divine. universal manifestation of the One Spirit.
Yeah.
But the worshipping, the bhakti, is a way, it's, I think I would say it's a means towards a complete self-reflection. And when the mirror is pure and the mirror is without blemishes, there's no need for the terms, there's no need for bhakti, there's no need to worship, there's no need to offer myself.
So that's beginning to touch on the next, you know, if you dust away the next level of my question, which is, and I say this very respectfully, I'm not in any way being antagonistic against anyone's own practices or beliefs or any established religions or traditions of any kind. I'm not. I'm just being completely naked, honest, sincere, asking these questions. Is a certain level of unawareness or, you know, unawareness, ignorance, is a certain level or degree of that necessary for the dichotomy that promotes me worshiping divinity? In other words, is there a necessary, slightly less level of awareness for that to be perpetuated, for that to continue and be meaningful?
That's a great clarification. Yeah, absolutely. I would say that it's the natural progression. You cannot directly experience yourself as one with ultimate consciousness in all things and all creation and every aspect of my self-identity, because that's like, you know, no one is born a mystic, or maybe we're born as mystics, but then we grow through fundamental changes as the human brain develops, as the nervous system creates the whole process of gathering information, creating separation, creating distinctions and boundaries, the difference between the inside and the outside. This is, at this stage, part of our evolution. There's nothing wrong with that. The development of this rational mind is part of what we need to move out from the prior evolution to the next stage of evolution. So it's like the cocoon,
like a stepping stone.
It's a stepping stone. So on this, you know, I know for myself, like when I was younger, first getting interested in spirituality, bhakti was very important for me. You know, offering myself completely, surrendering something greater than myself, because myself at that point was identified with the drop. One drop to separate from the great ocean of consciousness.
Right.
So even though I recognize that there is an ocean out there, I don't experience myself as the ocean. I'm only experiencing myself as the drop. And so gradually it's like I'm opening through thinking, through meditation, through prayer, through bhakti, gradually dissolving, dissolving, dissolving. And then I think we get to that point, like Ramana, like many of the mystics.
I'm so glad you just mentioned him. I'm so glad you just mentioned it, because you know I had to pull up my favorite quote from him to respond to you. And it fits, but if this is true and it resonates and oozes and feels totally true, it's recognized as true, then I don't know how the mechanics of it are working yet. And here's what he said, and I inverted it to make it flow a little more better, a better way for my mind. Only with pure devotion and surrender is the secret unveiled, and self, capital S, reveals itself to itself. And so what he's saying, as I understand it, is only with pure devotion and surrender of one's egoic, limited, subjective, false identity of self, is the secret unveiled. The secret being that you are that. The self reveals itself to itself. Oh, look at it. It was self all along.
Yeah,
it got caught absolutely. Up in the reflection in the mirror and thought it was me.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, the thing about this, there's no right and wrong. There's just stages. You know, a two-year-old is not wrong for being 2 years old. A teenager is not wrong for being a teenager, an adult, and, you know, a senior citizen. Stages of life, and each one has a has a precious quality to it.
Yeah.
So if I'm starting a spiritual path, you know, as a teenager, and studying this lens of creation through philosophy, through an understanding of the Vedas, through an understanding of science, through an understanding of art, whatever the path may be, bhakti, you know, it cannot jump through all the hoops at once.
Right.
And there's a preciousness to each stage along the way. What happens at some point is that the old just falls away spontaneously. You're not trying to, you're not forcing, you're not trying to get rid of the mind, you're not trying to kill the ego. No, you know, you're embracing all of that. You're embracing this phase of understanding as equally precious. I mean, why is it that that creates this until this becomes that?
Or remembers, you know, it is that.
Or remembers that it's already that.
Yeah.
And that is not separate from this.
This is gorgeous, what you're saying. And I love that you're reminding us, as I like to say, pushing, forcing, striving, and rushing are always an error, always the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And again, John O'Donohue with his metaphor of the seed, the soul has its own time, its own cadence, its own pace and process of germinating, sprouting, growing, and blooming. Mm. And you can't rush it. You can't force it. The fruit is ripe in its due season. But if I dare to say this, this question I've asked you tonight and my thoughts around it, I think are the beginning hints, whispers, essences of what might turn out to be piercing through this level that I have been existing at for so long in my understanding, in my true understanding of I am. And there are certain, as I mentioned to you before, there are certain rote prayers that I was taught that I cannot in good conscience and integrity, I cannot recite them anymore because they are not something I would speak as being true for me. But other things have replaced it, hopefully purer and higher, I hope. But I kind of am starting to catch the scent of the sweet ginger blossoms off in the jungle that way. But I'm not saying I'm there. I'm not. But I'm starting to get it. You know, I've come to the realization, as I said in the video in March, that bhakti worship serves us in the first place. We are the first benefactor of it, because when you go into a mindset of worship, veneration, devotion, this already elevates you and purifies you already. Yeah. And I personally don't think it matters which deity and tradition you are coming from and practicing in that sense. Others will disagree.
Exactly.
That's okay. But so it's already benefiting you to be in that mind state, that flow. But then, you know, the philosophical question, if I am an emanation of this supreme is, then what am I doing? I am.
So back to the Vedic tradition, where they speak about the three yogas. So you have Bhakti Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Kriya Yoga. karma yoga. So bhakti yoga is, you know, developing the heart, the functions of the heart. Jnana yoga is developing functions of the mind. And kriya yoga is developing the functions of the body. Now we tend to understand these three things in a very limited fashion. So when we talk about the heart, most people are talking about the emotional heart. The spiritual heart is something totally different, and it's got nothing to do with emotions. But the emotional heart is the gateway to the spiritual heart. So through the bhakti, the emotion, the devotion, you know, the offering of the self, the personal self. And gradually that offering becomes more wider, it becomes more fluid. And then it joins with the jnana yoga, with the understanding that the distinction between self and the other is starting to fade. This is what mysticism is really about. Mm-hmm. Like Rumi says, the first you are the drop then joins the ocean,
yeah,
and then the ocean enters the drop.
Yeah.
It's a phase. First you're the caterpillar, then you're the cocoon, then you emerge as a butterfly. You can't force it, but you can. All coexist. I'm here. I'm not trying to pretend I'm there, and I'm not trying to push myself there.
Right.
A caterpillar, you know, is not going to get anywhere by trying to pretend it's a butterfly.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, it's just going to do the opposite.
Yeah.
So I think this is the heart of mysticism. You're gradually letting go by embracing everything. You're embracing the separateness. You're embracing exactly where you are. You're embracing your pain, your fear. You're embracing the reason that you're afraid to let go and become one with everything. The reason that I'm holding on to this idea of mind and duality without trying to in any way make it less, or make it inferior, or make it wrong. I mean, these are, it's, that's why I say all that, unless I've done some psychological work, it's impossible to really go into the deeper aspects of the spiritual journey. So when I say psychological work, I'm talking about recognizing that we are living in an archetypal world, that there's sub-personalities, internal personalities that are distinct from each other, that need each other, that can communicate with each other. So that conversation that I can have inside myself with an aspect of myself that I deem to be somehow flawed, then that conversation extends into the interpersonal realm. So maybe then I start connecting with the higher self as something wiser and greater than the personal. Then I start surrendering to that, you know, very fluidly, very gradually. Surrender is totally important. You know, it's not like you're going to make anything happen. You just allow.
Yeah.
And then somehow that the soul aspect, or as Sri Aurobindo refers to the psychic being, the aspect of us that keeps reincarnating and gathers memories, gathers understanding and wisdom lifetime after lifetime, and grows from that. Then at a certain point, that soul aspect, that higher self, then is ready to open to the infinite as the infinite. So the only difference between a so-called enlightened person and a regular person, they're not going to look any different from the outside. They're still going to have the same organs of perception and the same means of perception. It's all going to come through the different levels of mind. The only difference is that somehow you're not holding on to one aspect of reality as the reality. And I think this is where Kashmir Shaivism comes in, because they talk about the tattvas. So, you know, you started off speaking about that, I am that. So in Kashmir Shaivism, first of all, there's Shiva Shakti. I am Shiva, consciousness, pure consciousness, infinity, beyond time, beyond space, Brahman. And I am Shakti. I'm the manifestation of Shiva as creation, the infinite bounty of creation. Everything that exists in worlds upon worlds, dimensions upon dimensions, universes upon universes, all of that is Shakti. So you start with, okay, I am Shiva. So it's a very, and this is what the Vedantists focus on primarily. I am that as Shiva. But then I'm that as Shakti. And then Shakti breaks down, you know, that beyond the veil, that within the veil of Maya. And then that comes down to I am Purusha, consciousness in this form, within this soul evolution, and I am Prakriti, so the inner world and the outer world, that which I experience through the senses, and that which I sense as something outside and separate from the experience. It's Purusha and Prakriti. Then you go down to, okay, everything out there, I am you. I am that tree over there. I am that, you know, piece of lint stuck in the middle of my book. You know, whatever it may be.
And it's not that literally you are that thing. It's that the thing which all things are, you are. That which all of these other things are, you are one and the same with that thing which all of these things are. In that
so the,
sense,
the
again, language.
The aspect of our being that is identified with this as the personal self dissolves. So then you realize there's no personal self anyway, never was. There's only that.
Yeah.
And so whether I see that in terms of something outside of myself, something inside myself, as an archetypal quality, as a fifth dimensional being, as an ascended master, as an elemental spirit or a fairy being, as a tree, as a waterfall, behind me, whatever it may be, it's like, and that's only what we can imagine beyond our current imagination. There's realms and realms and gods and goddesses and aspects and deities and archetypes of the self. So anything we can imagine, everything we can imagine is within us. And the closest I can come to really understand this is a dream. So when I have a dream, it's literally creating a world within the dream. When I wake up from the dream, I am all of it, it's inside me. But in the dream, while I'm associated or identified with the dreamer, that's outside of me. When I wake up from the dream, it's inside of me. So the whole distinction between outside and inside is this idea that the personal self and the universal self are separate from each other. And, you know, that's what alchemy is. Alchemy is basically as within, so without, as above, so below. And recognizing that and maintaining that and embracing that.
Let me ask you this. And also, first of all, I would just like to apologize to the viewers for the terrible Wi-Fi connection that Thailand offers. And I thank you for sticking through it. I have no control over it. I apologize to you. I have to deal with it constantly. The question that I would like to ask is, if there are certain entities, beings, devas, deities, gods, etc., supreme being, that we worship or venerate anyway, is it inaccurate, or is it correct to say that in doing so, we are venerating or worshiping aspects of I am, which are more highly evolved in their state than maybe we are right here, you know, as this now. And so it's kind of just like aspects that are coming along the way over here, which is us, are worshiping, venerating, revering aspects which are much farther along in this process, this arising, purifying, awakening, returning. And all of us are at the same time, I am. Is that too wild? Am I off on that? What would you say?
Yeah, I think that's well stated. So let's see, if I'm worshiping, say, Shiva, at one stage of my journey, I would worship him as this wild yogi, with, you know, his qualities and maybe an image that comes up in my mind. And it's obviously outside of myself because there's the great god Shiva. As I continue to experience a deeper relationship with Shiva, that becomes an aspect, it becomes an archetype. All right, so Shiva is an archetype that represents death and rebirth. It represents the dance of creation. It represents the union of Shakti within itself. And I begin to open to new insights, new awarenesses, to see how there's not so much separation as I thought there was initially. I still experience myself as Kiara. I still worship Shiva as something out there, but now it's no longer a form, but it's an archetype. It's become bigger than a form. The next stage after this would be, it's not even an archetype, it's a presence. And as presence, you get to that phase where everything is one. And when I experience myself as presence, or let's say deep presence as a mystic, then all the associations fall away, the words fall away, even archetypes fall away, and what's left is just is. And at that point, you are Shiva, you are Shakti, you are the infinite, but you're not seeing yourself as somehow, you know, more evolved or now totally enlightened or whatever. That aspect of you that was trying to get somewhere is gone.
Okay.
There's no getting, there's no journey. That at that point, you are the ocean, you're flowing throughout creation, you are creation, and you're beyond creation. It's like those distinctions are gone. And that's I think many people have those experiences from time to time. And then gradually it becomes an abiding presence. So this, you know, it's not like suddenly you're enlightened one day. Even Ramana, you know, he had to anchor and ground that experience he had when he was 16 in order to become the sage that he became. So it's like a steady understanding, opening, surrendering.
Yeah.
And then the ocean starts pouring through in its own time, in its own way, in its own unique capacity, through each person, through each element of creation, in its own unique way.
Yeah, it's a metaphor that might work is, you know, when you enter into prayer and you reach a prayer state or a meditation state, it's almost like dipping your toe into the ocean. You know, and each time you do that, you're dipping your toe into the ocean. Maybe then you start dipping your foot, and then eventually your legs, And then pretty soon you're standing in a shallow part of the ocean a lot of the day. And then later on, you're sort of, floating in it. And then eventually you are swimming in it and, like
And
diving
diving
in.
in.
And I love the metaphor you used in a previous conversation, let the ocean fill you. So eventually there is no outside of me and inside of me, because there's no more concept of me. And you come to realize that you simply gradually and incrementally shed all that wasn't you, all that wasn't really you, even if you had believed a lot of it was, you had identified with it previously. And I like that. I like that. But there is that sort of, but how am I going to breathe underwater kind of thing, the intellect, And so that's where this question of if we are that, why are we worshiping them kind of thing, that it comes from that gap, that missing piece in the awareness.
So let's look at this in terms of this phenomenon people refer to as channeling. So channeling, the way I understood it in the beginning was you're opening yourself to something outside of yourself, something bigger than yourself. So maybe, an ascended master, as we label it, or whatever it may be, some deity, or even, some human creature that's in another dimension. All right, or another creature, an animal spirit, spirit of ayahuasca. Anyway, you're channeling that. So you allow that to, it's like you, what actually happens is that your crown chakra opens, and this archetypal quality or this state of presence starts to enter. And it enters, you begin to learn to identify with that. So initially, when you start channeling, say, Archangel Michael, you connect with an aspect of this very real presence, but you can only take in so much. And so the information you get will be on that level. And gradually, as you become more identified, you become more surrendered, you start opening to other aspects of this as the higher, deeper, wider presence. And it comes with a vibrational quality. And that comes through you. And as that vibrational quality comes through, it starts changing the nervous system, starts changing the cells of the body. And now the body can hold more presence. And you continue, and you continue, and you continue. Until at a certain point, you're not channeling anymore. You are that. I am Archangel Michael. If I maintain my focus on that, I become that. If I maintain my focus on a tree, I become that tree. I am experiencing that tree as if I was inside that tree.
There's simply no more boundary. There's no more duality. There's no more otherness. Yeah, I can understand that. I've also noticed when I was studying Reiki a few years ago, as I got more and more involved in actually practicing Reiki, it brought things to the surface that needed to be released. It needed things that needed to be untangled and let go came up quick. If you're going to be engaged in this frequency, in this energy, can't have that. This can't work with what we're doing, that kind of thing. And so it kind of expunged, purged some things that, and I won't get into it now, but one of them was really very upsetting. I actually could not go through the whole thing alone, which I normally do literally everything alone. And with this, I had to actually reach out for some help. And what I got in the form of help was affirmation and a little bit more clarity of what it is actually that's happening. And then that made everything okay. And I carried through with the purging and the process. But yeah, I understand what you mean. The only thing I would say about channeling is I'm a little bit concerned when somebody says, they're channeling. There are deceptive spirits in the astral realm and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of potential for deception there, and I think that even the channeler, well, they would be the first one deceived,
Sure.
in such a case. So I'm a little wary of
Yeah.
that kind of stuff.
Well, I think it's also a reflection of, again, it's like if these higher aspects of our being can be focused and brought through conscious awareness, the unconscious mind is also very active. There's all the subtle conditioning of our human history that's, held within the cells, within the nervous system, within the miasms, as the homeopaths talk about. So this is like a subconscious veil. I mean, this is Maya to some extent. This is the veil through which we perceive reality. So whether it's a dark entity, which is a reflection of our own emotional imbalance or some fear, that then gets reflected as something outside of us, so we can actually see that more clearly. So the question then comes up is, okay, why am I here on this planet? Why am I choosing to be born, incarnate as a human in this dualistic reality, when there's all these other infinite worlds that I could incarnate and experience? Why? And I think this is where we really have to understand the beauty and the power of this dimension. Why is it that we have created duality as a schoolhouse, karma as a schoolhouse? It's because this state of contrast is the greatest stimulus for creativity. And if you're here to learn to become gods, we are experiencing that through contrast. What works, what doesn't work, consequences, right and wrong. And slowly, gradually, we are learning also about empowering ourselves, not giving up our power to something outside of us that we've learned to somehow deny ourselves or obscure or limit or suppress. It's really about owning, like that quote from Marianne Williamson that you spoke the other day. We are here to remember who we are on every level of our being until we finally remember ultimately. The schoolhouse has to do with contrast. And then the choice. Am I this clout that needs to learn through abuse and fear? Or am I this beautiful saint who is now ready to learn through surrender and empowerment? So
It's like my dear friend Bob said,
takes time.
we're here to learn love. Everything is ultimately pointing to love, and you may be learning it through a negative, what we would call a negative approach, not necessarily bad, but in other words, you're going to come to a far higher understanding of love by experiencing its absence or its contamination or its misuse. And we would say, oh, those are bad. Okay, on the surface, the experience and the effect of going through that would definitely, understandably appear to be bad. But wow, is your soul going to learn? Because you now have a very clear reference point to pin your understanding to by means of direct personal experience.
Exactly. Yeah, well spoken. So that's the purpose that we're here, and no matter what we're experiencing, maybe we're stuck in the middle of, a lockdown, can't move, can't travel, feeling really agitated, feeling really fearful, whatever it may be. Or we're stuck in the middle of a war. Maybe I'm in Ukraine. Maybe, there's this dance of military might. And, there's on the one hand, there's Russia. On the other hand, there's Ukraine, NATO. And what's going on? The contrast, the war, the state of fear, the state, and the qualities with that. So, one force may be trying to conquer, dominate, overcome, another side trying to defend, hold, bring some aspect of balance. It's not just about two nations or even, if you expand it out to what it actually is, which is basically NATO against Russia, unipolar reality versus a multipolar reality. But when you start to look at how through the last 100 years we've gone through these conflicts, World War I, World War II, all the wars that came afterwards, one nation that was identified with the hegemonic agenda to basically conquer and dominate economically and militarily the rest of the world. Or people start recognizing I'm no longer a serf, I'm no longer a slave, I am a sovereign being, and we're all of that. We're all that. And until every single nation, every single economy recognizes that, these wars will continue, because wars are a means for people to wake up to that truth that I'm not willing anymore to be a slave to, an elite force that pretends that is better than everybody else.
And Kiara, as you are well aware, I find it astonishing at the same time how many people are so profoundly asleep and how many people are now in waves waking up to things which
Absolutely.
people who woke up much earlier are like, well, yeah, welcome to the party. But also how many, and I know that you'll say this is their choice and we must respect it, and I understand that, but how many are saying no, and they're going to go down with that, they're going to carry that out to the end. So
Yeah, exactly. And that's okay. On a soul level, each choice is equally valid. And there's learning in all of it. On a soul level, it doesn't matter if you die in a war. It doesn't matter if you die from COVID or if you die from the jab. It doesn't matter if you decide that it's too much and I want to come back in another, in a different incarnation. And the truth is, this year, according to some data I've been looking at, more people have actually died than been born.
I'm aware of it. It's definitely another topic. I'm tuned in. I know what's going on. I think most who are viewing understand what we're talking about and are also to some extent aware of it. I have to disagree with you on something, and maybe you could convince me as we wrap up this topic for tonight. You said that the manner in which one dies has no bearing on the soul and all that. I don't know about that. And I say that because I have followed so many researches and stories about ghosts and spirits that seem to be trapped in limbo, which when we see them, we call them ghosts, things like that. And it's always due to some kind of trauma. Usually that happened at their death. For example, they were murdered, or they committed suicide, or they were killed in a bomb, or something very traumatic where They were suddenly and violently out of their body, not necessarily by their design or choice or flow and etc. And it has caused them to be, for some reason, unable to move on and move out. And so they seem to be suspended or trapped. And the other thing is, regarding terminating your own life, there's many who would say you're in for some serious darkness when you get on the other side if you do that. And now we have to be careful about what we would love to believe is true and what is true. But somewhere in the middle of that is the fact that I think we don't really know. I don't think we really know for sure. But I just have a feeling that there are things that can affect, let's say, the trajectory of the soul's path. And so what you said is that it doesn't matter how you're out of the body, it has no effect on the soul. What am I wrong in my understanding?
I think this is a really good question for a full session sometime.
Okay, another topic for another day.
I'll just say very quickly, yes and no.
Okay.
On the
Okay.
one hand, on the
We can no,
one
we can
hand,
leave it at that
from
and
the
make another episode about it. There's certain questions that are their own conversation, and so that can be one. And I'm
You're
sure
right.
that our viewers share these same curiosities, and I don't think we know so much, and to know that you don't know is the beginning of wisdom. So,
Wisdom.
I don't think we know all that. But any final parting words regarding bhakti, worship, devotion, and where we should go with that, with this new understanding? What should we do?
Well, one step along the way, which I think is important in the movement of bhakti, is usually there comes a point which some mystics call the dark night of the soul, John of the Cross being one, which is very much a part of the journey. And usually what will happen is you hit that bump on the way where you feel empty, depressed, emotionally as well as spiritually, as well as physically, is just in every possible. You don't no longer feel motivated to continue what you were doing, even your spiritual path. You feel like you're at a stuck dead end. What now? For some people, this may last a long time, and many people go through this over and over and over again. Eventually, you learn to walk through it, and eventually, it's very quick. But I think there's a power to this in the dark night. It's what happens when you're ready to move on to another stage. And then what happens is that everything that has been hiding in your subconscious conditioning starts to get frantic. It's like, oh my God, I'm gonna hit another level of awakening. Am I ready for this? Do I want this? What's my fears? What's my what if I end up losing everything or losing my friends or losing my security, my identity? That's a death, and you're
Well, there
terrified
you just
of
said it. I was
death.
going to offer that dark night of the soul is a kind of death that precedes a kind of birth. You could say a re-death and a rebirth. It is the ending of a past template, chapter, phase, way of being, consciousness, frequency, all those things. And it can be painful and difficult, and I know this very well, and I'm sure you do too. But then, lo and behold, in due season, you arise again, the resurrection from the tomb, and I promise you, your suffering is not in vain. As long as you know how to perceive it and make use of it in the right context, and as long as you stay present and aware and receptive and always in a state of forgiveness, thankfulness, and love, you will make gardens of compassion, as Rumi said, from your grief.
Absolutely, yeah. And also just recognizing that there's a purpose to this is sometimes enough. Yes, I know this is hard, but there's a purpose. And it's a good reason.
Yeah. Resting in the unknowing, which later you will come to an understanding in hindsight. But in the forefront, I think another sign of wisdom is to abide in restful trust in the face of unknowing as a babe to his mother's bosom.
St. John of the Cross also spoke about the cloud of unknowing.
You know,
so it's like here's this beautiful, bright sun, and around the sun there's a dark cloud that veils it. And we have to pierce through it in order to let that light shine upon us.
Yeah.
You know, again, I'm talking in dualistic terms.
Yeah.
But when you pierce through it, that dualistic aspect dissolves and you become the sun. So, you know, like we talked about Shams the other day. Shams is the sun. And what he brought to Rumi, the gift he brought to Rumi, was allowing Rumi to pierce through the security, the
confines,
identity, the status that he was so identified with.
Yeah.
And as he pierces through, it's like, oh my God, I'm lost, I'm done, I'm finished. You know, I'm gone. And then you go through that cloud of unknowing and you become the sun. That's what Shams means.
Shams reminded me
means the sun.
Exactly. And you just reminded me of the time that I bungee jumped. It was like 250 or 300 feet high. I don't know exactly, but it was tremendously high on this, this metal like column or tier. I don't know what we call it. It was like a crane and going all the way up. And then lo and behold, I'm standing there on a small piece of metal, which is literally only big enough to put your 2 feet. And they swing the metal door and lock it behind me. And now that's it. And they said, we're going to count 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and you go. And I can't tell you how mortified I was. I was so tremendously scared. It was unbelievable. But I was able at that time to say, despite the fear, I trust and I will fall. I will not flail and, you know, all this. And I won't even jump. I will fall forward. And I put my hands out like they said. And I said, all I have to do is allow myself to fall and the rest will take care of itself. And I did it. And from the time I leaned forward to the millisecond before I rebounded up, it was absolute terror. And the moment the cord rebounded back up, it was absolute ecstasy. And I couldn't wait to get up there and do it again. And it's kind of like a metaphor, you know, for what it's like to pierce through. You know, it was a death. That jump was a death. And the second I hit bottom, you know, hit the end, I didn't hit bottom, hit the end and bounced. Yeah. It was inexplicable. I've never felt more alive kind of thing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Couldn't wait to go do it again. And if I had to do it again, I would be terrified to lean forward again because it's a scary thing, you know, but that you made me think of that metaphor. So, and also I would like to acknowledge that you unwittingly said a lot in your responses today regarding the butterfly coming out of the chrysalis, the cocoon, when it is time, not pushing and fighting its way out. And also you brought up the dark night of the soul. I didn't spur you to say any of these things. And I just, in light of those pearls of wisdom, I want to give a very warm greeting to Daniel in Colombia and let him know that your spirit has resonated with us here today. And I hope that you're watching and you've gotten something from this. And to all of our viewers on both channels, I want to thank you for your subscribing to the channels and for your viewing and sharing and commenting and liking. It does matter. Thank you. And to you, Brother Kiara, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for another wonderful conversation in our continuing series. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Blessings.